We're in the middle of our study of a shadow of good things to come. Sometimes hard for us to realize how much God did to prepare for the coming of Jesus. And that's our fault. That's our failure to know what God was doing and see it so clearly. The world has many holy books, books that different groups, religious groups, cultures look upon as somehow being inspired or a guide to life. But the Bible is truly unique, and this is one of the ways it is so unique, is how things that were written long before, the things having to do with Jesus, talked so much about Him and pointed to Him, and how He then fulfilled those things when there was no way He personally could have done what it took to fulfill them. Things outside of His power or His own abilities nevertheless made it possible. Where He was born, when He was born, the circumstances under which He was born, how He grew up, the things that happened to Him surrounding the last week or so of His life before He was crucified, all of those events were outside of His power to manipulate and control. And yet, not only did they happen, God had foretold them and predicted them in various ways long before. Call your attention to a little story at the end of the Gospel of Luke. As I get older and read the Bible more, I wonder more and more, wonder in the sense of be amazed at the things we read there. In Luke chapter 24, after Jesus' resurrection from the dead, we have a story starting in verse 13 about two disciples of Jesus who are on the road. They're leaving Jerusalem on the same day He was resurrected from the dead, and they're traveling down to another town named Emmaus. Now, Emmaus was about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they couldn't just get in their car and drive down there in 10 minutes like we can. Their standard mode of transportation in that day and time was walking. And so if you're going to go to Emmaus from Jerusalem, you plan on 3 to 4 hours just to walk there. And that's if you don't stop and take a break. So that's a trip. 3 to 4 hours of walking to get to Emmaus. And these disciples of Jesus, the story tells us, as they're going out that road, that dusty road from Jerusalem to Emmaus, are discussing the things that have happened. First of all, they're all the things that had crushed their hearts. Jesus suddenly being arrested by the authorities when they thought Jesus was about to be coronated as king. That's what they thought was going to happen. They believed in Him so much, and yet the authorities had taken and arrested Him, tried Him in the middle of the night, and had the Romans crucify Him up on Golgotha. And He died there. Where was the things they had looked forward to? This caught them totally by surprise. And then as He was taken down from the cross, right in the midst of the Passover celebration the Jews were having, put into a tomb, borrowed from a secret follower of His. And then on this very morning that they're starting out to Emmaus, word had come back to them that some of the followers of Jesus had gone to the tomb and found it empty. But more than that, they had seen angels there who told them He was risen from the dead, and even some of the women who were followers of His said they had actually seen Him. Now in Jewish culture, hope you were not offended by this, but in Jewish culture, the testimony of women was not acceptable. Women were never called to testify at trials. Their testimony wasn't acceptable. And yet the disciples have heard from some of their women that they've seen Jesus alive, so they don't know what to make of it. Now, if some of the men had said, "We saw Jesus alive this morning," maybe they wouldn't have been in quite as much of a quandary, though even so, the very idea that a man would be crucified and then 3 days later people would be seeing Him alive again was beyond the realm of believability even for them, no matter who said it happened. And so they're discussing these things as they're walking, have started their trip down to Emmaus. And as they're walking along, they're discussing it. Someone else is walking along that road, seemingly maybe comes up sort of behind them and says, "What are y'all talking about?" The stranger seemed to find it curious, the things they were talking about. And so they sort of let him join the conversation. And they said, "Are you some stranger who just arrived in Jerusalem? You don't know about all the things that have happened?" Well, I'm sure there were many strangers in Jerusalem at Passover time. And probably not many of them actually did know too much about what had happened with Jesus. They were actually there for Passover, and they didn't know the background to the story of Jesus. They hadn't been in Judea or Galilee for the last 3.5 years and didn't know about his miracles and about his teaching and about the conflict with the authorities and all of those things. So they said, "Are you a stranger here that you don't know about this Jesus that many of us thought was the Messiah who was crucified by the authorities this past week? But now we've received word and we're hearing from some that he's alive." And whoever this stranger is, he can tell that they're really in a quandary about making something out of all of this. And suddenly they hear the tone of the stranger change as he says, "You really are quite foolish. You don't even believe what your own scriptures say about this man Jesus." That had to have caught them by surprise. This stranger seems to know more about Jesus than he first let on. And so from then until they actually arrived at their destination, the stranger that had joined them talks to them about what all the Old Testament said about Jesus. And again, I remind you, they had 3 to 4 hours to talk about it. Not just a few minutes. And as they arrived at their destination and they went into the place where they were going to stay for the night, they asked this stranger to join them for dinner. And it was often the custom when you had a stranger who was a believer like you, you would ask him to offer the blessing at the meal. And as they asked him to offer the blessing, suddenly in whatever he said, they recognized that it was Jesus himself. I suspect we're sort of like these men sometimes. Traveling through the Old Testament for us is kind of a dusty road too. And even though we meet Jesus there, we don't often see him for who he really is in the Old Testament. This morning, as we talk about those things in the Old Testament that were a shadow of the good things to come, we're going to talk about one of the festivals, one of the most holy days that the Jewish people celebrated every year. It was called the Passover. Now, in 3 weeks by our calendar, the Jewish people of our day will celebrate their Passover. In case you had never picked up on that before, they celebrate it at the same time we in Western culture celebrate something we call Easter. Maybe you've wondered why our Easter moves around through the calendar from year to year. It's because it is based upon whenever the Jewish people celebrate their Passover. And we have other holidays. You know, July 4th is always on the 4th of July. It just works out that way. Christmas is always on December 25th. But this holiday we call Easter is based upon when the Jewish people's calendar says they should celebrate their Passover. Why is our Easter tied to their Passover? Let's see. We find the story of the Passover and its beginning back in the book of Exodus. Back there, the descendants of Abraham and his son Isaac and his son Jacob had gone down at the end of the book of Genesis to Egypt and were living down there because of a great drought that extended over an extended period of time, more than 7 years, up in their land of of what today is Israel or Palestine. And they had gone down to Egypt to live down there because one of the sons of Jacob, Joseph, was in a very high position in the Egyptian government. And he could provide for them and protect them. And they settled down there and they continued to live there. Maybe a lot longer than they had originally intended. They ended up living there and their descendants for over 400 years. And in the process of those 400 years, not only did they multiply from just some 70 people to several million, their position in Egyptian society also changed from guest to slaves. They ended up becoming the slave class in Egypt. And the Egyptians, particularly the Egyptian government and the Egyptian Pharaoh, used them for some of their great projects. We see some of the great pyramids and the Sphinx and the remains of some of the great Egyptian temples. We don't know how many of those Hebrew slaves actually helped build. And they still exist today. But finally, God says it is time for these people, my people, to leave Egypt and go back to the land I gave to their ancestor Abraham. And so He raised up a man by the name of Moses to lead them. I'm giving you the very abbreviated. This is not even the Reader's Digest version of the story. This is much more abbreviated than that. But He raised up Moses and sends Moses to the Pharaoh and demands that he lets these people go home. Well, that would be an economic disaster for Egypt to let these people leave because they were the most basic working class of Egypt by now. And more than that, it would be a insult from the Pharaoh standpoint to even grant people of no status such a request. He's not going to do that. And so a contest begins between the head of Egypt, who considered himself a god, by the way. The Pharaoh thought of himself as a god. And the god of the Hebrews, the god of Moses. And God, one by one, sends these plagues upon Egypt, which the Pharaoh has no power or ability to prevent or thwart. And Egypt suffers greatly. And several times during that process, the Pharaoh will say, "Oh, if you'll just stop this plague, these different things that are happening to us, I'll let these people go." But as soon as the pressure would be taken off, he would withdraw his word. Until finally, after nine of those different things have happened, God says there'll be just one more, and He will let these people go. And so in Exodus chapter 12, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, "This month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. And if any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the people of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat those lambs. That same night they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or cooked in water, but roasted over the fire, head, legs, and inner parts. Do not leave any of it till morning. If some is left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you're to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover." So God sends a word through Moses to the people, "Everybody get ready. Everyone take a lamb on the 10th day of this month, and keep that lamb until the 14th day of the month. And on the 14th day of the month at twilight, as it is moving into from evening into dark, you kill that lamb, you roast it, you make unleavened bread because you haven't had time to let the bread rise from yeast. And then you're to eat it that night. You're to take the blood from the lamb when it's killed and put it on your doorpost. They would dab a spot over the cross beam over their doors and one on either side. And he says you eat it as if you're ready to leave on a trip. You don't eat it in comfort and ease. Instead, you already have your walking clothes on and your walking stick in your hand. And this is all obviously some kind of a very symbolic thing they're doing. But what does that have to do with God delivering them out of Egypt? Remember, these people have lived down there for over 400 years, they and their ancestors, and they've been nothing but slaves. These nine miracles, these nine plagues that have come on Egypt, were as much to convince the Jewish people that God was doing this as it was to convince Pharaoh that they could trust God and Moses to lead them. And now he says this, on that same night I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both of men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. And then down in verse 29, at midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead. And during that night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, up, leave my people, you and the Israelites, go worship the Lord God as you have requested. Take your flocks and herds as you have said and go. And the Egyptians urged the people to hurry and leave their country. The tenth plague brought death in Egypt. The firstborn of every family in Egypt died, even the firstborn of all their animals. But among the Jewish people, the ones who had taken the lamb and slaughtered it and taken its blood and put it on their doorpost, no one died in their houses. And the Jews were not very sophisticated people, and so they started calling it the Passover, because God passed over them. They left Egypt the next day. They and their flocks and the things they had, and the Egyptian people even gave them of their own possessions to make them go. And so they carried many of the riches of Egypt out with them. And other slaves who were not even Jewish went with them. Slaves from what is today Ethiopia and from other nations as well were set free. And they all left and moved out towards the Red Sea. And we know those other stories about crossing the Red Sea when God opens it up and eventually they get to Sinai, the great mountain, and while there, God gives them a law of the Ten Commandments. But He gives them a lot of other laws too, and among those in Leviticus chapter 23 is a commandment that annually they were to celebrate the Passover again. It was to be a commemoration, a remembrance of what God had done in delivering them from Egypt. It was instituted in Exodus 12. It was, I guess we would say, legalized, made a regular part of their annual practice in Leviticus chapter 23 and Deuteronomy 16. And they celebrated it all the way down until the days of Jesus. And among Jewish people today who have not become Christians, they still celebrate it today. Over 3,000 years after what happened in Egypt. But why are we talking about this story? Well, we're talking about things in the Old Testament that were a foreshadowing, a symbol, a representation of Jesus. In the passage that Don read for us at the beginning of the service this morning, in Luke chapter 22, the Jewish people celebrated, according to Leviticus 23, three holy times right together. They celebrated the Passover on the 14th day, the 14th and the 15th day, actually, of the first month of their year. And then that 15th day was the first day of 7 days of a second holiday called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And on the first day after the Sabbath day that would fall in the middle of their Feast of Unleavened Bread, if you can keep up with this, so that would mean on the first day of the week, we'd call it Sunday, they would then celebrate a third holy day called the Feast of First Fruits. Because once they got into this land God was taking them to, and they settled down there, started planting their crops, this would be just at the time when the very first of their grain crops would start reaching fruitfulness or time for harvest. And so they'd take some of the very first grain out of their crops on this first day of the week and bring it to the place where they worship God and present it to Him as their first fruits. It was a reminder that God had brought them here and given this to them, but it was also a promise that there was more harvest to come. And over the next 4 to 6 weeks, then, they would take in all of their harvest. And then 50 days after that celebration of the first fruits, they would celebrate another festival called the Pentecost, as it's called in the New Testament, where they celebrated the end of the harvest. And that what had started with the first fruits now was seeing its full fruition. Well, try to keep some of that in mind as we're talking about these things, because when Jesus is doing what He's about to do here, they're doing two things at once. They're celebrating the Passover and the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, because they came together on the same day. And so it says, "Then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, 'Go and make preparations for us to eat the Passover.' 'Where do you want us to prepare for it?' they asked. And he replied, 'As you enter the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him to the house that he enters. And say to the owner of the house, "The teacher asks, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?" And he will show you a large upper room, all furnished. Make the preparations there." This is an amazing thing. Jesus, as a Jewish man, and his disciples, as Jewish men, had been celebrating Passover ever since their birth, every year. And they knew by heart everything that was involved in it. They also knew that the Passover could only be celebrated, as it said in Leviticus 23, at the place where God put His name. That meant, by Jesus' day, Jerusalem, because that's where the temple was. And that's where God had put His name. So it had to be celebrated in Jerusalem. It could not be celebrated in Galilee. It could not be celebrated anywhere else except in Jerusalem. And everyone who lived within 15 miles of Jerusalem was required every year to come up to Jerusalem, and all Jews everywhere were encouraged to come as often as they could to celebrate it. The typical practice, if you lived in Galilee, which was some 55 to 70 miles away, was to go every year, even though that was outside of the 15-mile radius. And so Jesus, having grown up in Galilee and Nazareth, would have gone every year, I'm confident, and so would have his disciples. But because of that, and because so many people came every year, you had to make your arrangements way early to make sure you had a place to celebrate it. To give you some idea of how many people would come in, we're talking about a city that maybe in Jesus' time had a population of maybe 50,000, 60,000. And yet, a historian of that time by the name of Josephus writes in his History of the Jews that in the year AD 65, now that'd be about 35 years after the events we're reading here, but about 30, 35 years after that, the governor, the Roman governor at that time, writes a letter to the emperor Nero and says, I don't think you understand that I don't have enough troops here to handle these Jews should something happen. Now that turned out to be pretty prophetic because just 5 years later there was a Jewish revolt and the Romans had to send in massive troops and armaments to actually end up destroying the whole nation and city and temple and everything. But the governor writes Nero and says, I don't have enough troops to handle these Jews because during one of their feast days, they have a massive number of people coming in here. He said, well, every year they celebrate something called the Passover. And he says, at least 10 Jews have to participate around each feast. And he said, the high priest tells me that this year they killed 256,500 lambs for Passover. Well, 256,500 lambs times 10 people per lamb is over 2.5 million people in Jerusalem in a town of maybe 50,000. They were everywhere, literally, on the hillsides, in the streets. Everywhere people could be, there people were. So this was a big deal. And so if you were going to get a room and have a regular place to have your Passover in Jerusalem, you need to make that arrangement way early. And yet here it is, the day of it, and his disciples are asking Jesus, Jesus, where are we going to celebrate the Passover? Now that's, you know, typical man thing, last minute. But what do we find? Jesus had already made all the arrangements. He even told them how to know who it was. He said, when you go into town, you'll see a man carrying a water jar. Men did not carry water jars. That was the job of women. But here's a man carrying a water jar. And Jesus said, when you see a man carrying a water jar, follow him. Wherever he goes, you go into that house and tell the owner of the house that I've sent you. And he'll show you the room that's already been prepared. Jesus had already made all the arrangements. They left and found things just as Jesus had told them. So they prepared the Passover. When the hour came, Jesus and his apostles reclined at the table. And he said to them, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. Now he's already been telling them for over a year that when he goes up to Jerusalem, that he's going to be arrested and crucified. And they didn't believe him. But here he is telling them again that he's about to suffer. But did you hear what else he said? I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you. Well, he's eaten a Passover every year for the last 30-something years. Every year he's been alive. And they have too. Every year they've been alive. So what's so different about this one? It's on exactly the same day of the year as every Passover was, exactly the same ceremony as every other year. What is different about this one that he would say, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you? And then this they began their Passover celebration. I wish we had time to talk about what all they would do that night as they celebrated the Passover during Jesus' time. We have pretty good Jewish records that tell us what all they did. All the different things that were on the table and different things they did. But as they're doing this, Jesus says, "For I tell you, I will not eat it again until it finds fulfillment in the kingdom of God." Jesus is suddenly telling them that something about this Passover is going to find its fulfillment in the kingdom of God. You see, for the Jewish people, they always saw the Passover as, first of all, historic. It celebrated a historical event. Secondly, they knew it was tied in with their agricultural practices because just in 3 days after that or four, they would be celebrating their Feast of First Fruits that began their harvest time. They also knew it was sacrificial because a part of it had become to offer sacrifices up at the temple as well as killing this lamb that they were going to eat. But now we're also hearing it was prophetic. It apparently was predicting something else to come. And it tells us that in verse 17, after taking the cup, he gave thanks and said, "Take this and divide it among you, for I tell you, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes." Jesus tells them that as he's drinking and they're drinking of this cup, which was, of course, it was part of their Passover celebration, but almost every meal the Jews had when they could sit down at table in a house, they would have wine with it or the fruit of the vine. Jesus says that this is the last time he's going to drink it until he drinks it in the kingdom of God. And then he took the bread. This would be the unleavened bread, which was part of the Passover celebration. He gave thanks and broke it and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." When the Jews celebrated the Passover, as they took the meat, the roasted lamb, and it was distributed among them to eat, they were eating a body that had been given for them. Back there in Egypt, when that lamb died, and the blood was put on the doorpost, the lamb was eaten, that lamb gave its body for them. Now, as Jesus is taking this unleavened bread, he tells them to take and eat it. "This is my body given for you." And in the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you." And the lamb died in Egypt. And then every year when they, in commemoration of that, killed the lamb, the blood that was spilled of that lamb saved their lives. When God saw the blood over the doorpost, he passed over that house. The death of that lamb and the shedding of his blood saved those people in Egypt and brought them out. But now, as they're eating in celebration of that, here over 1,000 years later, Jesus says, "Take, eat this bread. This is my body given for you. This is my blood poured out for you." See how he's connecting what they had celebrated for over 1,000 years with something else that's about to happen. For it will be the very next day that Jesus will be nailed to a cross. Blood will pour from the wounds in his hands and from the wounds on his head where they press a crown of thorns down on him and the stripes on his back where they beat him. And his body will hang on that tree until at twilight he dies. And then a soldier will come and with a spear stick his side and blood will pour out. a shadow of things to come. As I've just thought about the Passover they celebrated and what Jesus was about to do, I noticed some of these points of correspondence. It said in Exodus that they took the lamb on the 10th day of Nisan. Nisan was not an automobile in those days. That was the name of the first month of their year. And it was called Nisan because in Hebrew, the word Nisan literally means the flight, or they fled. That's the month they fled out of Egypt. They took the lamb on the 10th day, but they didn't kill it until the 14th day. But tells us here that here on the day the lamb is to be killed, Jesus celebrates this Passover with his disciples. And then later that same day in Jewish time, because according to Jews, a new day began at sunset. So we'll pass through the night when he'll be arrested and tried, and then early the next morning they'll take him out, and by 9 o'clock they'll have him nailed to a cross. Or take him out to be nailed to a cross. So he'll die on the 14th day of Nisan, just like the lambs did. But I wonder what happened on the 10th day. Fortunately, the gospel records allow us to count back and see what happened on the 10th day. You know what happened on the 10th day of Nisan this year? Jesus, who had spent the night in Bethany with his good friend Lazarus and his two sisters, Mary and Martha, Lazarus's two sisters, Mary and Martha, on the 10th day of Nisan, gets up and joins the travelers who are coming into Jerusalem. Jesus hadn't been in Jerusalem in 6 months. He had been out of country for 6 months. But on the 10th day of Nisan, he comes into Jerusalem and the people give him a celebration. What's called the triumphal entry. Palm Sunday in some Christian traditions, where the people are waving the palm fronds and laying their coats on the ground in front of him as he comes riding in on a donkey, as the prophecy said the king would when he came. And when he hit town, I'm using a colloquial expression there, I realize, but when he made town, immediately the Jewish authorities move into action to carry out a plan they had laid down 6 months before when they said, it is necessary for one man to die so that our nation might be saved. On the 10th day of Nisan, they marked him for death. But it will not be until the 14th day that they kill him. That's what they did at Passover in Egypt. The lamb was picked out and marked for killing on the 10th day, but they didn't slaughter it until the 14th. It had to be a perfect lamb. Jesus challenged these very people who are going to kill him. He says, which one of you can convict me of any sin? When he stood before Pontius Pilate at his trial before the Roman authorities, Pontius Pilate said, I find no sin in this man. I find no fault in him. A perfect lamb. The death took place as the sun was setting. At twilight, between 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock, Jewish time was twilight. That's when the Passover lamb was killed. That's when Jesus died. The lamb's blood was shed. So was Jesus. This could only happen in Jerusalem. That was the law. That's why Jesus had to die in Jerusalem. In Exodus chapter 12, whenever they were taking the lamb to be killed for the Passover, one of the ordinances was that not a bone of its body could be broken. It had to be whole. Even though Jesus was badly beaten before he was crucified, no bones were broken. And even as he was hanging on the cross, the soldiers came around at the end of the day and broke the legs of the two men who were crucified with him to hasten their death. But when they came to Jesus, he was already dead. And so they didn't break his legs. No bones were broken. When the Passover was instituted, a part of the law was that whatever they couldn't eat that night was to immediately be disposed of. Nothing was to be left overnight. The Jewish authorities came to the Roman soldiers and said, "You need to get them down off the cross before nightfall. We cannot allow dead men to be left on the crosses overnight." And that's why they, as the sun is already down, they're taking Jesus' body off the cross and quickly wrapping it in linen cloth and putting it in a borrowed tomb because it could not be left overnight. As the Passover law had said, even though the Jewish people, Jewish authorities were not trying to see the Passover fulfilled in Jesus, it was being fulfilled. In Egypt, the Passover saved the firstborn of Israel. It kept all the firstborn children from dying. Jesus was the firstborn of God. But more than that, it says that those who are His disciples today are the church of the firstborn ones. God looks at every one of us who are part of His church today and says, "You are in the position of the firstborn." The Passover lamb saved the firstborn. And it was to be a perpetual commemoration of what God did there. We have such a perpetual commemoration. Of all the many different varieties of Christianity, and we wouldn't in any way try to justify or even explain all the different things that Christianity and different groups of Christians and those who call themselves Christians have done over the last 2,000 years, there's probably two practices that have been consistent with almost every single group of those who claim to be Christians. One is baptism. And the other is a regular commemoration of our Passover lamb. We did it just a while ago with the things that were on that table right over there. Unleavened bread and fruit of the vine. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and in verse 7, Paul writes to the Christians in Corinth and says, "Get rid of the old yeast that you may be a new batch without yeast as you really are. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us keep the festival, not with the old yeast, the yeast of malice and wickedness, but with bread without yeast, the bread of sincerity and truth." Christ, our Passover lamb. But we can only eat it if we're God's unleavened bread. Now certainly He said He was that bread in a sense, but we also are to be bread without yeast. We're to be holy bread. That's what the Jews looked upon unleavened bread as being from the time of the Passover forward. When they ate unleavened bread, it was always with the thought, "This is sacred bread. This is holy bread." Because it does not have yeast in it, which they saw as a kind of corruption. And so Paul tells the Corinthians they need to be God's unleavened bread as they continually celebrate the Christians' Passover. A shadow of good things to come. So today, the body that was given for us, we commemoratively ate. And the blood that was spread on the doorpost for us, we in commemoration drank to remember continually what was done for us. Just like the Jews celebrated their Passover to remember what God had done for them.